combating the idea that nursing home injuries are inevitable. Stick around. Hey out there, welcome back to the Nursing Home Abuse Podcast. My name is Rob. I will be your host for this episode. We're talking about the idea that negative outcomes in nursing homes are not inevitable, that just because we have a vulnerable population in a particular facility doesn't mean that we should expect to see bad things. But we're not doing that alone. I'm not going to just babble for 30 minutes. We have a fantastic guest. Trial lawyer Michael Hill will be with us to talk about that and actually to talk about a significant verdict he recently received. And with that, let's get into the, the housekeeping of the episode. And as we know, that housekeeping includes the nursing home regulation question of the week. This week, I would say the difficulty level is medium. If you get this, give yourself 49 points. Under 42 USC 483.10F4 little I, a nursing home must provide immediate access to any resident for A, the resident's lawyer, B, the long-term care ombudsman, or C, the resident's Uber Eats driver. And that answer is B, the long-term care ombudsman. Under that specific regulation, the nursing home must provide immediate access, meaning it doesn't matter day or night, immediate access for the resident if the resident consents for the long-term care ombudsman to enter. And of course, now it's time for the ChatGPT generated nursing home regulation joke of the week. Gentle reminder, everyone, this is AI's attempt to blend United States code with humor. So set your expectations to mildly disappointed. Gene, can you cue it up for us?
The ChatGPT generated nursing home regulation joke of the week.
Skynet.
Under 42 USC 483.10G, nursing homes must give you your medical records because nothing says light reading like a 1,000 pages of MDS assessments.
And there you have it, folks. Proof that the singularity is still outside of our grasp. All right, let's get into the substance of the episode. I'm absolutely thrilled to have trial lawyer Michael Hill on the show. Michael Hill is the founder of Michael Hill Trial Law, and he specializes solely in nursing home abuse and neglect cases. With over 57 and 8 figure settlements and verdicts, he secured nearly $100 million in the last year, including Ohio's largest nursing home verdict. Frequently consulted on nursing home and assisted living facility cases, Michael has sought after to try cases previously handled by other firms. So basically one of the best, and so happy to have him on. Michael, welcome to the show.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here. Appreciate it.
So I typically don't do this, but I want to put a spotlight on you. You recently launched your own nursing home abuse firm, correctly? Correct?
So that's right. So I actually launched a firm originally in 2017, had a partner. And then just within last week was the official announcement of Michael Hill Trial Law. So yeah, I'm very excited about it. Got a great team with me.
Excellent. Okay. I just wanted to get that right out of the way. Like if, and where do you practice or where are you located?
Yeah. So I'm actually located right outside Cleveland, Ohio. But I practice, it's kind of interesting the way my practice has developed over the years. So I probably got on average about 50% of my cases are in either Western PA, Kentucky, West Virginia, or Ohio. And then I tend to get brought in to try cases kind of wherever. Which to me, I think is very fun to be in new jurisdictions, places I don't know. I think it's a challenge just to show up, kind of parachute in, especially in, rural Georgia, for right. example. I've got a case coming up. I'm from Flint, Michigan. I couldn't be more northern. Wow. So it's kind of a fun thing just to parachute in and see how it goes.
Oh man, we got to talk about that. Great. Thank you so much, Michael. So I guess what I want to do today is typically in nursing home cases, there's just a general perspective that these are quote unquote broken individuals. They're mm-hmm. old, sick, and dying. And what happens to them is inevitable. We all meet our maker. So what are you complaining about? Why are you asking for this much money? Why do you value the case in this way? And I wanted to have you on just to kind of just in a broad sense, how do you approach that in your nursing home cases? How are you, what's your thinking and how do you respond to something like that?
Yeah. So I think that idea, they're kind of old, sick, and broken. I think that's an attorney idea more than it is a general public idea. You know, we've been really over the years inundated with insurance adjusters and defense lawyers, you know, hitting us with these very low valuations because that's what attorneys settle them for. And they've got their algorithms are built on that. And so, you know, these cases are worth hundreds of thousands of dollars, let's say, for that exact reason. But when we get in front of a jury, my experience has been very different than that. You know, people in the community tend to some extent, cherish the elderly, and they see these as very vulnerable people, you know, very similar to disabled people or to very young people, you know, infants. And they're people that societally we're supposed to protect. And if you have people on your jury who, you know, have perhaps neighbors in this situation, have parents in this situation, you know, I go through part of my voir dire is to ask people who do you love most in this world, just to kind of get that out of the way. And you'd be shocked how often the people they say are my dad, who's on hospice, or my mom. So I think it's a conception that we as attorneys have really bought into, pushed by the insurance industry, and frankly, by other attorneys who have historically settled these cases for very nominal amounts. And so I think that old, sick, and dying situation isn't really something that the jury thinks of. I think the jury thinks of these people, more similar probably to you and I do, as very vulnerable people that need to be taken care of. And so that idea of, well, they're old, sick, and dying, maybe, but they're still great members of our community. You know, I've represented, you know, Korean War veterans and World War II veterans and all these people that have done amazing things. And the jury understands that this case is not the final moments of someone's life, the last 6 months of their life, the last year of their life. It's, you know, 75, 85 years of being a great human being. And that's what we're looking at. So in my experience, I think that it's just getting in front of the jury and getting yourself out of that zone of, you know, lawyers and insurance people telling you what a case is worth.
That's a fantastic perspective. So it's one of the ways that you cut that off at the pass is you understand, okay, the jury's here, you know, in voir dire, listen, you know, who do you value? Who are the people that you look up to? And then they, you know, whoever they say, they're linking to your client. And in that way, the person has value. What about the perspective of the actual nursing process? So in terms of defending against the old, sick, and broken arguments, like, for example, like, well, you can't say that until you've done the assessment, the plan, and the revision. Can you talk about that? Does that factor in?
Tell me a little bit more, if you could.
Yeah. So can we really say diabetes and peripheral artery disease caused your pressure injury when you didn't put the individual on a turning repositioning program or assess them as a high risk and therefore have more interventions, by way of example? Do you approach it that way? And if you do, is that also something in voir dire that you talk about? And not just pressure injury, just in general, whatever the nursing home type cases.
Yeah. So, and what we see in these cases, and you're aware of this, is that everything's unavoidable, right? Falls can't be prevented. Pressure injuries are clinically unavoidable. And I think that I've taken a very common sense approach to that, which is it may be true that some falls are unavoidable. It may be true that some pressure injuries are clinically unavoidable. But you can't say that until you've taken every single step to prevent it, right? That's a common sense thing. It's not unavoidable unless you've done everything to avoid it. And again, I think it's a situation that juries understand. And when you go through, you know, these care plans and everything else, and the federal regulations, you know, there are state surveyors guidelines, and they break down what these are. And it's exactly that, right? A fall is not preventable unless you go through, or it is preventable, you know, unless you go through this entire checklist of things that you've done. So again, juries understand that. And I think very basic rules to use with nursing staff, things like, you know, if a fall is preventable, right? Because their defense is always, oh, not all falls are preventable. If a fall is preventable, your job as a nurse is to prevent it, right? Very simple. Yes, right? That means that you have to take all steps necessary to prevent the fall, correct? Right? Obviously, there's some you can't tie people up, but all legally available ones. Yes. So when you get those very, they can't say no, right? So when you get these very concrete examples and concrete rules, we all know that when it comes to nursing care and nursing homes, they don't have the staff to do these things. They don't have the staff to even do the assessments properly. They don't put real interventions in place. The interventions they put in place are passive ones, you know, mats on the floor and bed alarms, right? So we always know that there's going to be failures along the way. It's part of the nursing home industry. It's built into the process. They're not going to profit if they have the staff and training to do this. So if we have these very concrete rules and very basic rules that everybody can understand, right? It's not unavoidable unless you take all steps to avoid it, right? You have to take all steps to avoid it. You have to take dot, 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 dot. Again, I think these cases become very simple. And I think that we can outsmart ourselves to some extent, right? And I equate nursing care, like, let's be honest, this is not cardiology, right? This is not how do you treat a stroke or prevent a stroke or those kinds of things where you've got real judgment involved. These are just doing your job. And if you break it down to your job is X, right? And if you don't do your job, right, you're responsible for what happens. Everybody can, and standard of care is just a job performance. Everybody on that jury can understand what it is to do your job and that you have to do your job. And if you can get these basic rules, your job is to fully assess the patient. Your job is to, you know, put every intervention in place that's legally available. Your job is to prevent all falls, pressure injuries, whatever it might be that are preventable. If a pressure injury is preventable and you don't prevent it, you know, you're on the hook for any damages that are caused. Very basic things. And I think if we keep things basic, things are easy for the jury to understand. We don't overcomplicate ourselves. I think it's difficult for them to bring an expert in and contradict their own staff and say things like, no, you don't have to prevent falls that are preventable, right? That's nonsense. And if they do that, fantastic.
In the vein of keeping things simple, what is your approach with respect to, you mentioned understaffing a second ago, what's your approach to linking the understaffing on a particular day or a week or a residency to the actual negative outcome? Like how do you simplify that for the jury?
So I did it the more traditional way in the past, which was to, you know, look at the regulations, which was to get the Medicare expected staffing, which was to compare their staffing to that and get very complex. And what I realize is, one, you've kind of lost the common sense issue at that point. You've also injected kind of a battle of the experts, right? You've got one expert saying it should be this way, which then brings up another expert saying it should be this way. So what I've also realized throughout the years, and this applies across the board, I think, is that experts to some degree are a necessary evil. I've had lots of juries tell me that they kind of cross each other out. So what juries, you know, agree with are real people, right? That's powerful to them. So I think there's three potential avenues of evidence. One is your family itself, right? Your family itself probably has a lot of good information. I would come in and he wasn't changed, or she was lying in her own waist repeatedly, or we'd use the call light and this would happen, or, you know, we'd go and here no one's at the nurse's station and it's lit up like a Christmas tree, right? So that's kind of one avenue. The other avenue are the families of other residents, right? So, you know, as we know, you know, evidence doesn't have to itself, a piece of evidence doesn't have to prove the case, right? It's just a building block. And if you have the family members of other residents who you can find, I think somewhat relatively easy through things like Facebook, those kinds of things. If you have family members who come in to say at the same time, this is what was happening with my family member, right? Again, it's adding to the credibility of your own clients. And then I think the most powerful is former employees. And former employees, I think in a lot of ways carry the day. It's they're able to give you kind of the inside scoop, right? They're able to tell you what the working conditions were actually like. They're able to tell you on a given day, you know, sure, I don't care what the staffing says, right? Whatever their level says, I don't care on their documents. You know, I would be responsible for 27 patients on my floor. I'd be, you know, trying to change someone and a call light's going off and somebody's screaming and people would wait for hours or 2 hours to be changed. You know, that's testimony I've gotten numerous times at trial. I've had testimony where they say, look, I'm really sorry. So-and-so was neglected because of this exact thing. And former employees are so powerful because it's nearly impossible for the defense to credibly cross-examine them because they've got to explain why was that person who's willing to come into court and lie? Why were they working with this very vulnerable population? Why were you allowing to work them, right? It's really a double-edged sword. And the way I think of this evidence, family members, resident, you know, family of other residents and former employees, I really look at it as social proof, which we know is a real thing. That's why we like Amazon reviews. That's why we look to Google reviews. That's why when we look at one of them, you go, well, I don't know, maybe this person's kind of crazy. Who knows? They gave it one star, but you see 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 of those. You go, well, look, this all seems to be adding up. How could they all be wrong and I'll be lying? This product is garbage. Well, it's very similar. One former employee can get cross-examination, you know, cross-examined, disgruntled employee, whatever. 2, 3, 4, 5 of those, much more powerful, very difficult for them. And you couple that with what family members have seen, you couple that with potentially what other family members of residents have seen. And I think you've got a relatively unbreakable case when it comes to understaffing without turning it into a battle of the experts with things like expected staffing, which is very complicated, versus minimum numbers that the defense wants to bring up, state minimums. All of that becomes a bit of a muddled mess in my experience. Real people saying what they experienced, juries will draw the right conclusion. And the benefit that we have as nursing home plaintiffs lawyers is that juries have an expectation going into it that these are profit machines. They've been there. They've already given us that inference. So that to me is the most powerful evidence, which is real people saying what they actually saw.
I'm reading this book called Show the Brief. And kind of the main thesis is that when you're drafting a motion for summary judgment, even a complaint, to put graphics in, whether it's be pictures or graphs or whatever, because most people tend to remember things if they're visual, especially when it's visual with text. And as you were talking, that kind of, I guess it makes sense that your preference, rather than these, you know, pinhead geeks talking about numbers and it's a battle of these people and it gets lost, you have an individual that goes in and go, yeah, I was a CNA there. Mm-hmm. Every day I went in, I had to take care of 30 people. You can visualize that. You can, yeah. you can be that guy. And that sticks harder and is more potent to the juror. I definitely agree with that. I definitely can see what you're saying.
Yeah, absolutely. And the other part of that is, you know, what motivates juries here, in my experience, is the corporate issue, right? The corporation making decisions that are little profit siphoners, right? That's what each one of these little entities is. And the nurses then are not necessarily the bad guys. The nurses oftentimes are victims in this as well. Right. So them coming in and explaining, like, look, we wanted to provide care. I couldn't, you know, broke my heart. I walked off the job because I was so frustrated one time, whatever it might be. That also, I think, inspires the jury to actually make change because this is happening in their community. Right. So it's not just some geek egghead coming in saying they're understaffed. It's the real world example, and also upsets the jury, as it should, that, look, they're taking advantage not just of these residents, but of everybody in our community. You know, here's a here's a lady who wants to do her best and she's going home crying at night, but she can't quit. She's got a kid with who's disabled. She got to put food on the table. And that's a real example from a trial.
It's you're right. It's provides the why. Like, okay, they're understaffed, but why? Oh, mm-hmm. it's a malevolent why. Mm-hmm. They're siphoning money. And as a result of that, that's why the person wasn't able to take care of all the people.
The other thing that I think goes with that, if I could, mm-hmm. is that nursing homes are great at putting together a shell game, right? They may own a real estate company and that owns the building. The nursing home itself has an exorbitant rent. They're paying off that building every 2 years with an absurd rent. But it's difficult to pinpoint exactly where that money is going without making it overly complex. Juries understand going into it that nursing homes make a lot of money, and they connect that understaffing to the amount of money they think they're making. And in my experience, they're relatively accurate. Okay. But when you get the eggheads in the room looking at all of this data and all of this information, they're putting up evidence that they're running at a loss, which sometimes is true. It's just that the money's being siphoned to these other avenues, and tying that all together can be very difficult, even for lawyers to understand. So for juries, it's, I think, totally lost in the weeds. But when you have corporation, parent company, they get all that. Parent company owns 150 nursing homes or whatever. You've got this understaffing at the local facility. They get that. They put that all together and understand, look, there's a lot of money being made here. And when you put all the specifics and the different corporations and the management companies and the real estate, and you're trying to connect all these dots, again, it can all just fall apart in front of you because it's so damn confusing.
It's not a majority, but there is a substantial amount of nursing home attorneys that I've talked to that keep it a medical malpractice case. They don't talk about cost reports. They don't talk about understaffing. They don't talk about, or at least they don't talk about the numbers of understaffing. They might bring in the former employees to make that, that pump fake, to make that assumption, but they don't touch it for that exact reason, that it's extremely complicated and you lose the jury.
Exactly. And I try to do exactly that. And I try to keep trials short for that reason. And, each witness, I try to keep on these former employees for maybe 10 to 15 minutes, right? They've got a point to make and they get off. And, you can get 30 of these, I shouldn't say 30, but you can probably get 10 or 15 of these, former employees in half a day, maybe three quarters of a day. And you could win the trial right there, in my experience.
You recently had a pretty substantial verdict, at least in my opinion. On a nursing home case. Can you kind of briefly talk about what that case is about, and then specifically talk about how you overcame the defenses of, this person's going to get an infection. This person is going to, be sitting in a chair and be immobile, and therefore bad things will happen to them. Can you kind of talk about the case, talk about how you dealt with that?
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. So, I think the case you're talking about involved a 69-year-old schizophrenic. He'd been institutionalized for his entire life. No dependents, no children, obviously, no marriage. He had four siblings who were, they were spread out across the country. And, one was in Missouri, one was relatively local, but, saw him 2 to 4 times a year. A brother down in Georgia who had Alzheimer's, couldn't visit, and a sister who was mentally ill, so really wasn't too involved and certainly couldn't testify at trial. So that's the damages case moving forward. So not what we would think of as attorneys as ideal. And, I looked at the records and, it was refusal, punching, biting. It was, you look at it initially, go, man, how can you provide care to this guy? This is really tough. And it was a case where he had lost a substantial amount of weight over the course of a year. He ultimately had aspiration pneumonia, very unclear from the records what actually happened. And he was, taken to the hospital with aspiration pneumonia in very poor condition, sent to hospice after that and died, and kind of a goofy death certificate. So you look at it and you think, man, this is not ideal. Right. This is not what we would walk into and think this is a great case. So the way to overcome that is, again, former employees. and they really carried the day. So as I got into the case and started talking, and this is a case I came into relatively late, not relatively late, I think would be quite late, probably about 3 months before trial is when I first came on board. And essentially nothing was done. No depositions had been done. It was a race to the finish. Okay. So, you know, the first thing was former employees, and it just was like an onion that was being, you know, stripped away. And so when I was talking to former employees, I'm talking about this guy who seemed so combative and seemed so bad. And they said, no, he was a wonderful guy. You know, he loved Motown. He would sing. He had this beautiful singing voice. He was so friendly if you approached him the right way. And, you know, I'd ask about things like, you know, all of these refusals. And, you know, they said, look, these refusals, we did document refusals for him, and we documented refusals for all kinds of people because we didn't have the staff. And we were told by management that if we just didn't provide care, then state would come in and they'd inspect and we'd get in trouble. We'd get dinged. But if we had a refusal documented, then they'd look at it and go, well, you tried and you couldn't provide that care. So, you know, I'm talking to them. I say, are there any kind of patients specifically you're doing this for? And they said, yeah, you know, patients who are nonverbal or patients who have psychiatric disorders, because they're either not going to be able to speak up or no one's going to listen to them when they do. So I'm seeing this and going, well, look, this guy's losing weight over the course of this year, certainly, you know, and they're telling me that they have a pattern of documenting refusal when it's not happening because they're understaffed. So that's, you know, beyond aggravating, right? I'm never going to get that, number one, in a deposition where they've been prepped by the defense, right? I mean, they're admitting fraud. And the other thing was, you know, this guy, he has aspiration pneumonia. It's massive aspiration. So it's not like you're just, you know, aspiration pneumonia is when you get food or fluids, for any listeners, in your lungs, not air. And that can develop into pneumonia, or even you can suffocate if it's large enough. So I'm looking in the records, and there's a few instances where it looks like he's scarfing or wolfing, which is where you're shoveling in food. So you're literally inhaling food, if you're allowed to, inhaling it in your lungs. And so he needed close monitoring for that. And I talked to the family and they said, yeah, look, he's had that since he was 19, when he was diagnosed. You know, it's a thing where you just literally scarf down food. So I talked to the staff about that, and they said, yeah, what would happen is he would puke. If he wasn't supervised and told to eat slowly, what he would do is eat so fast, he'd puke it up. We all knew that was a risk, that he could end up choking or aspirating on it, as chokes it up, can't swallow it. So again, it was all right. So I that's a very good chance of what happened here. And as it was more and more and more former employees, what I realized is, unlike what they were supposed to be doing, which is monitoring him, assisting him, take small bites, et cetera, they didn't have the staff to do that. So what they did is they would just take him, put him in, you know, a chair with a lap over it so he couldn't move, and would set him inside of a doorway. He's also blind, I should have said that, where he can't get up. So he's in there shoveling food completely by himself. And I talked to aides, and they said, look, I would come in on the second shift after he was given lunch, and there'd be food all over the floor because he's doing it and he's puking. And if you sat with him, he would never happen. So again, now we have a really good reason for why this is actually happening. And it just continued that way. And so by the time we were in front of the jury, you know, they were so appalled. You know, so the first witness I put on comes in and, you know, actually starts crying on the stand, looking at my client, who's the sister, saying, I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry that we neglected your brother.
Wow.
We shouldn't have done this. So she's crying. And then my client, of course, is crying. So she's apologizing to my client. My client says, no, I understand. Right. This is the situation we're done. And the judge is like, stop. You guys can't have this conversation. Right. But you look at the jury, it's over. Like, that was the first witness. We're 15 minutes into the case, and the jury is sitting back just shaking their head, like, I cannot believe that this is what happened. Jesus. To this guy. And after that, you know, it was just kind of piling on, right? Because again, they cross-examined her. She wasn't there the whole time. She hadn't worked there in a couple of years before this happened. But it was piling on and piling on and piling on. These witnesses were all confirming it. And when we got to the experts, you know, the experts were really, they weren't making the rules of the case. They weren't essentially telling us what standard of care was. They were verifying why what the nurses said was important and was the standard of care, right? They're not coming in to say, hey, jury, let me tell you what the standard of care is. They're coming in to say, what that person said, that's right. That is the standard of care. And here's why that's so important. And I try to do that as much as possible because it takes the battle of the experts away. Mm-hmm. It takes the, well, I'll just kind of make the experts awash. It's, we already have all the evidence and rules, common sense things from the witnesses, the jury's already endorsed. This is just confirmation of, yeah, that is the rule. That is the job. That is the standard. And here's why not doing that is deadly. And here's what happened in this case. And I think it takes a lot of pressure off of the experts because they're not carrying the day at that point. It's not listen to them. That's what the case relies on. They're providing a reason for why what the lay witness said is the rule. They're not coming in to create the rule, if that makes sense.
That absolutely does. That's an amazing, horrific story, but an amazing result for you. And I think what's interesting is that I'm saying to you, tell me about that most recent incredible verdict. And you're like, I think you're talking about this one, which means there are many. So the hat's off to you that we don't know which amazing result we're talking about. Well, Michael, this has been a fantastic conversation. I really appreciate you coming on the show and sharing your knowledge with us.
Absolutely. Anytime. I really appreciate it.
And before we let you go, what is what's the best way if someone wanted to get a hold of you, somebody, you know, maybe has a loved one in a nursing home in Ohio, in the Western Pennsylvania, the area that you told me about, how would they get a hold of you?
So my email is michael.hill@protectseniors.com. You can just contact me directly. The website is protectseniors.com. And not just referring a case or anything like that. I always encourage people to reach out to me. One of my favorite things to do is people have a case just to talk about it, right? Just to brainstorm, trial strategy, et cetera. And the other thing, if you don't mind me giving a little bit of a plug here,
sure,
is out at Trialor University, I've got a masterclass June, I believe, 5th and 6th, I believe are the dates. 2-day masterclass, 12 hours. I actually have tickets that I'm allowed to comp people. So anybody who actually wants to, I'm happy to comp them the tickets. I think they're $2,200 each. I have the privilege to do that. I think up to 10 or something like that. So please reach out to me, anybody who's interested, because I want people to be doing a great job in these cases for a couple of reasons. One is that everybody deserves it. And two, ultimately my goal, as ambitious as it might be, is that we break the algorithm that these insurance, you know, carriers have developed over the years.
That's the dream. It is the dream.
It's an ambitious dream, but that's the dream.
Very gracious of you, Michael. And then that puts the fire under me to make sure this episode gets out before June. So again, appreciate it very much. All right. Well, I hope that you found this episode educational, informative, perhaps entertaining. New episodes of the Nursing Home Abuse Podcast come out every Monday for the foreseeable future. If you have any suggestions for topics that you want to see me or a guest cover, please let me know. If you're watching this on YouTube, please be sure to like and subscribe. If you're listening to this on a podcast, I don't know how you leave reviews, but if you figure it out, let me know and then actually review this one and give it a good one, hopefully. And with that, folks, we'll see you next time. Thanks for tuning in to the Nursing Home Abuse Podcast. Nothing said on this podcast, either by the host or the guest, should be construed as legal or medical advice, nor is intended to create an attorney-client relationship between the host or their guest and the listener. New episodes, for now, are available every other Monday on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or on your favorite podcast app, as well as on YouTube and our website, nursinghomeabusepodcast.com. Again, that's nursinghomeabusepodcast.com. See you next time.